What I wanted to do was I wanted to encourage my students to do what I was then going to try and do in my own work, which was peel away the formal prohibitions to my own content. But of course, they didn't have them yet because they hadn't professionalized like I had. So they didn't have the same level of prohibition against their own content. And as soon as I gave them permission in a context, it was like taking the lid off of a boiling pot.
It's a conundrum. If you're an artist, you want to make something that has an impact, that lasts. But on the rare occasion that you actually achieve it, that work can sometimes define you. That almost happened to Judy Chicago. Emphasis on almost. Over the past half century, few works of contemporary art are as recognizable and widely celebrated as Chicago's iconic installation, The Dinner Party, now permanently housed at the Brooklyn Museum. But with the opening of a new retrospective at San Francisco's De Young Museum, visitors will finally see The Dinner Party for what it is, an early course in a diverse and decades-long tasting meal. The exhibition includes approximately 130 paintings, prints, drawings, and ceramic sculptures, in addition to ephemera, several films, and a documentary. It runs through January 9th, 2022. We recently spoke with Judy Chicago as she was in deep preparation for a site-specific performance in her ongoing series of smoke sculptures. What's a smoke sculpture? We'll get to that. From Philbrick Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. I think we should begin with talking about the smoke sculptures. As of this recording, you are preparing to do an installation there in San Francisco. This is not the first one of these, but they're all slightly different, obviously, based on location. First, just kind of tell us what you kind of have intended to do with these smoke sculptures, where the idea came from, and also how you pull it off, because when I look at them, they look like a huge undertaking.
Well, Forever De Young is definitely a huge undertaking, as I wrote and drew in my trip record that I'm keeping from all this travel. I did a little drawing of me and Donald staring at the structure, which is 30 feet high, and we saw it yesterday. And the drawing says, even though we designed it, we didn't think it was going to be so big. It is really formidable. It's probably the largest piece we've done. And I started doing atmospheres, what is what I call them, in the late 1960s as a way of trying to soften and feminize what was an incredibly macho environment in terms of the Southern California art scene. And over the years, they've evolved. And I did one in the Bay Area in 1974. It was commissioned by the Oakland Museum, and I did it on the shore of Lake Merritt. And it was a 200-foot wingspan butterfly form. It was the first time I ever tried to create an image with what I used was something called lance work, which is how they make scenes in fireworks. And then through an unfortunate combination of events, I had to stop and I couldn't get any bigger. I didn't have enough support. And I started again in 2011 in relationship to Pacific Standard Time. They did a performance festival and they invited a lot of the artists who had done performances in the 60s and 70s to either reprise earlier pieces. Or in my case, I picked up where I left off. And since then, I've been experimenting with mixing color in the air. And that is a really big advance on the early ones, which were all sort of on the beach. They were on flat ground until I did Butterfly for Oakland, but that was still on the side of the bank of the lake. This, I think I started dealing with tiered structures, I think was in Miami when we did in 2018, a purple poem for Miami. And that was a hand-built wooden structure, but it was only, I think, about 8 feet high. But one of the things I saw then, and also when we went out to the desert with Pyro Spectaculars, who we've been working with since 2011, because, you know, when I started, you didn't have to have a fireworks company. I used to just buy the smoke and then go out with my friends. But now it's like a big magilla, you know, it's got to be permits and it's got a whole thing. Anyway, so we were testing actually for the Toronto piece, which will be at the end of the 2022 Toronto Biennale at the beginning of June. And it's going to be on a barge. Okay, so imagine you're going to be standing on the waterfront and there's going to be this barge in the middle of the water. And it could, the piece could really get lost in the vastness of the water. And so I started thinking about building a higher structure so that it would have presence on the water. So we were in the desert doing tests because these pieces take a year. And in the case of the De Young, we've been working on it for over 2 years. And we actually built a section of scaffold and higher. And what happened was, because the smokes were, the color smokes were at different levels, we saw that in addition to mixing on the ground, they started mixing in the air. And that allowed a whole different expressive potential in terms of color, which of course has been one of the hallmarks of my career. And in Forever De Young, we've built on that idea. And in fact, we're doing something that we've never done before. The pieces are generally like calculated on a 15-second time basis in terms of ignition of the different colors. But this time we've done that, but with the idea that we could actually introduce color spontaneously. So let's say the purple and blue, which tend to go gray, will be getting gray, and I'll be able to say to Chris, let's introduce some white and lighten that color up. So this piece is another step in the development of the potential for color effects. And it's particularly appropriate, I think, now, and it's one of the reasons the Schnitzer Foundation wanted to sponsor this, which they're doing in honor of Jordan Schnitzer's mother, Arlene, who was a board member at the De Young for a long time, is because, you know, we're emerging from this really difficult and challenging period. And, you know, we're not even sure if we're really emerging or if it's just like we're getting a little space and then we're going to have to close down. And so Jordan was very interested in providing a joyous experience, a shared experience, which, you know, there'll be people in the park looking at the piece, and then we're live streaming it so that people all over the world will be able to see it.
Hearing you talk about testing it in the desert and everything, it's like this artistic Manhattan project, all the logistics that go into it. The piece is an extension of the retrospective that you have there at the De Young, which is a pretty massive exhibition.
It's the first retrospective I've ever had.
Ever?
Ever. And actually, Hyper Allergic did a review of the show and started with, it's very hard to believe that the, quote, iconic Judy Chicago has never had a retrospective. But it's true. The iconic Judy Chicago has never had a retrospective. And I have to say that the curator, Claudia Schmuckley, has done a remarkable job. And one of the things she talked about in the catalog was my use of color across my career. And there are images of some of my early smoke pieces as part of the show. So she was very keen on actually giving people the opportunity to see one.
In your recent autobiography, which I read and really enjoyed, you talk about kind of the shadow of the dinner party and kind of getting outside of that. And I wonder how this exhibition, as you put it together and you thought about it, because it really does cover this full spectrum of all the work you've produced. How did you go about, in partnership with the curator, thinking about defining yourself? Since it is your first retrospective and you say, okay, well, what does retrospective mean to me? How can I, you know, say something about myself? Because you have the autobiography, which is in word form. This is kind of the same thing in a way in this exhibition form. Did you use those as kind of a mirror for each other, this chronology? How did you put that together?
Well, first of all, that original plan was not for the flowering, my autobiography, to be published a month before the opening of the retrospective. The retrospective was delayed a year because of the pandemic. But as it turns out, having the flowering come out in conjunction with the retrospective has given a lot of people the opportunity to learn about my story and my struggle and to understand what a miracle the retrospective is. Because as I talk about, you know, the dinner party for a very long time in terms of the art world defined me. Judy Chicago, the dinner party. That's all anybody knew about my career. And even though, you know, that was a lot of attention and continues to be attention paid to the dinner party, I used to go around saying, I wonder if the body of my work will ever come out from the shadow of the dinner party. And so I'm very happy that it has, because there is work that people have no idea about, actually. And the word I heard uttered most at the opening was revelation. It's a revelation. And the other question I've gotten in terms of that by some of the people who've interviewed me is why the art world tried to keep out half of my career, which has happened. I mean, I've had dealers who simply refused to show certain bodies of work, who've said, even though I've worked in glass for 10 years, I don't do glass. So one of the things in terms of your question that was a big concern to me is that, okay, because of Pacific Standard Time, my early work began to be more known. And of course, it's my most neutralized work in terms of content. Although there's no question that in the work of the 60s and the early 70s, I developed the building blocks of my career in terms of color and form. But it was at a time that had I revealed my gender through my work, it would have disqualified the work. So I tried to bury some of the issues I was really interested in about the nature of femininity, female sexuality, female agency, although it kept creeping in, actually, I must say. And then, of course, the dinner party, which everybody knows, and the Birth Project, which is beginning to be more widely known. Okay, so the conversation Claudia and I had to do with, I didn't want people to do what the art world had been doing, which is after the Birth Project to begin to encounter really difficult subject matter that I've dealt with, the Holocaust, extinction, mortality, and go around saying, oh, her early work is her best. Because really, my early work is not my best, but it is definitely my most comfortable in terms of audiences. So Claudia had the brilliant idea of reversing the chronology of my retrospective. A lot of people commented on this. And I was actually talking before the show, I was talking to Tom Campbell, the director of the De Young, and I predicted that this is what was going to happen. People would come in, and of course, they don't know anything about the end, a meditation on death and extinction. And that would make them uncomfortable, you know, because people don't really like to think about death, and they certainly don't want to think about what we're doing to other creatures on the planet. And then they get to some of my glass, and they'd say, I didn't even know she worked in glass. And glass is like, wasn't it decorative? And then they get to the Holocaust project. The Holocaust, you know, if you went even today into most major contemporary museums, you wouldn't even know the Holocaust happened. And yet when Donald and I, my husband, photographer Donald Woodman, and I were researching for the Holocaust project, which took us 8 years, in most Jewish institutions in America, the Holocaust is described as the most fundamental and pressing philosophical dilemma of our time. Okay, so then there's the Holocaust project. Then there's Power Play, okay, which 30 years ago, I dealt with toxic masculinity before there's even a word for it. Okay, then the Birth Project. Okay, well, I know a little bit about the Birth Project. And of course, you know, she took on this subject when there was very little subject matter and it's, very little art about it. And of course, it's a universal experience. And then they got to the dinner party room, even though they can't see the whole dinner party, which actually would have taken up almost a third of the space if they could have. You know, even if they don't like it, they know it's now in history. And then they'd get to my early work and they'd go, breathe a big sigh of relief.
It's like a palate cleanser, you know.
Yeah, it's like a palate cleanser. But actually, that's not what's happening. People are really fascinated by particularly the end. And there's been a lot of tremendously interesting and incisive writing about what people have been saying is that a lot of the subjects I've dealt with, even though there was no discourse at the time I dealt with them, they've become much more pressing issues now. Climate change, extinction of so many species, you know, the Me Too movement, toxic masculinity, you know, so it's been interesting.
It seems as if the world caught up with you. You haven't changed. You know, you've been doing the work the whole time. And there was that moment where you got noticed and the dinner party was kind of perceived. And I think one of the things is we're always trying to define artists. And it's very difficult to define you as one thing because you've done so many different things. You are you, but the work itself. So I think there was an attempt to define you with that piece.
Right.
And then when other things happened that weren't that piece, it was like, well, hey, how do we define her within this?
That's right.
And so it's interesting that you kind of just had to wait it out. It seemed like as if the world has caught up with you. And now with the book and the retrospective and also just the work that you're doing generally and in your presence, you know, it's like this kind of culmination. Do you feel like that there's kind of this moment here?
Well, yeah. I mean, at the press preview, which caught me completely off guard. I mean, I got really choked up at the press preview. You know, in 1979, when the dinner party premiered at the San Francisco Museum of Art, the then director, Henry Hopkins, said to me, Judy, this is the culmination of your career. And I was not yet 40. And I said, no, Henry, I'm just getting started. But now I feel is actually the culmination of my career, in part because I've achieved a lot of the goals I set out to achieve when I was young, you know, which was to become part of art history, to make a contribution, to change. And then after my experiences in Southern California with how inhospitable the art world was to women, to try and create change so that women artists and artists of color could be ourselves and themselves in their art making, because it was impossible in the 60s. As I said to you, if one's work revealed one's gender, sexual persuasion, race, ethnicity, it disqualified your work from being taken seriously. It was marginalized. And what I was saying to you earlier, that is kind of a miracle that finally my body of work has emerged from the shadow of the dinner party. You're absolutely right about how the art world tries to define artists in very narrow categories. And when I was young, I always felt like I didn't fit in. I wanted to fit in because I was young. And now I don't want to fit in, actually. You know, I've created my own path and created my own career in a way. Because an artist who's as visible as I am that usually happens through a powerful curator or collector or museum or gallery. And I never had any of that. On the contrary, you know, I used to go around saying the art world wants to kill me, basically. They want to deny. I mean, in the 90s, there was all this writing about how the dinner party was a relic of 1970s feminism was passé. I was a relic. I mean, denied the influence of the dinner party, denied my influence as an artist, even though it seems like every week we get some kind of Google alert or Instagram, see an Instagram post about, for example, somebody doing a dinner party in their own community, or people doing woman houses in their community around the world. So, you know, I used to say I lived two lives, which was very confusing. It was like my public life, because wherever I went, lots of people came to see me, and then my art world life. And it's only recently that those have actually come together.
What you said there is fascinating to me, in the sense of, you know, kind of having to depend on people at that time and kind of letting critics and everyone else kind of define you. Whereas when the advent of social media comes out, you adopted this pretty early on, and it gave you a tool in a way to kind of go around those conventions and speak to a certain audience and kind of have a voice in a way that, you know, you may not have had before. And you've been utilizing social media, unlike many of your contemporaries who may have someone, you know, post a thing here and there, but you kind of get a sense that it's not really that artist or that person. It's kind of more of a legacy. It's like a catalog, you know, basically online. But your presence on social media is very robust. It's very vibrant. And it feels like an extension of you and your personality. Did you kind of do that strategically, thinking that that would be great? Or why did you want to get involved with social media and have that presence?
That's very interesting. When I published my first autobiographical writings, which was Through the Flower, My Struggle as a Woman Artist, which my mentor, Anna East Nin, suggested I do, which was incredible. Suddenly, I realized that the book and the pictures were reaching all over the world, because Through the Flower was published in multiple languages. So it was as far back as then that I realized that there was another avenue to introduce ideas and images. And then when I did the dinner party, because there was too much information when I was doing research, there was too much information to get into the visual work, I decided to do the piece, an accompanying book, and then also, and fortunately it happened, a film. So now I'm entering the culture with information about women's history through three avenues. That was the beginning of my building an international audience, although I didn't realize that that's what it would accomplish, because Johanna Dimitrakis's film, Right Out of History, The Making of Judy Chicago's Dinner Party, was played all over the world. It was played in Canada, it was played in England, it was played in the Nordic countries. And then a lot of people wanted to see it and discovered that the dinner party had become the piece that everybody wanted to see and nobody wanted to show. And then they got furious, right? And, you know, then maybe they read Through the Flower. And at that point, I began to build a very broad audience. That was continued during the Birth Project. Now, remember, I did the Birth Project in the 80s in the Bay Area, which was kind of the center of the alternative birthing movement. And at that time, there were very few images of birth in the art world. So again, a lot of the people who had seen the dinner party, particularly all the needle workers who had gotten interested and flocked to work with me on the Birth Project, the whole needlework community opened up to me. And then I began to have problems about how do you cross audiences. In other words, you know, I had some art world audience, but the art world is very small. I had China painting, and the China painting world was huge then. I had needle workers. Okay, so the art world knew nothing about China painting, nothing about needlework. The needle workers and the China painters knew very little about contemporary art. So now I'm trying to bridge audiences. My point here is that my audience has been built over the decades. When social media started, I knew, because I saw it, that Instagram was becoming the major social media of the art world. You know, because people would say to me, you know, check out my Instagram, you know, artists would say, and I didn't really know very much about social media, okay? And it was actually a woman who worked at Jessica Silverman's gallery, which is my West Coast gallery. She said that I should really have an Instagram account. So we started an Instagram account and I wrote about myself. And she said, Judy, why are you writing in the third person? And it was because I didn't really understand the immediacy and the personal investment in or the kind of currency of Instagram. And I can still remember her saying to me when I had about, I don't know, 800 followers or something, she said, Judy, you could have 10,000 followers. And I'm like, really? She said, but you have to write in your own voice. Okay, so from the beginning, once I started doing that, I also started looking at a lot of posts. And, you know, I myself am not interested in what people ate for dinner. And I'm not interested in what clothes they bought or their lipstick or anything like that. Just like all my other expressive modes, writing, making art, visual performance, whatever, I want what I do to be meaningful and educational. So I started out from the beginning with the idea of using Instagram as a way of educating audiences. And that's been carried through into our staff because I am not that tech savvy. So we now have young people who are on our staff. We used to have a thing about the youngest person on our staff had to take over social media because they would know, oh, TikTok, you have to do something on, you know. Anyway, we've, of course, expanded both my Instagram and we do Facebook. And, of course, through the Flower, the nonprofit arts organization that we started going back to the dinner party. And they have a space in Belen in New Mexico, where we live, and they also use social media a lot because there are a lot of young people who work there. And I've discovered not only do people tell me how much they like our Instagram because it has meaning. I've been trying to make sure it has meaning and says something and is not just about what I ate. And although I must say that the videos that we've posted about Ronnie Torres doing my hair always gets like a huge number of views. And then there's the videos we do of my beloved cat Tuxedo, who like takes over my Instagram. He's like, probably should have his own Instagram site. But at this point, I have over 60,000 followers. And I've also discovered that I can communicate directly and correct people's misperceptions. So for example, around what we were talking about, my atmospheres and multi-pigmented performances, you know, because there's a kind of knee-jerk reaction to the idea of smoke, oh, it must be toxic. I've been able to actually directly confront that and say, no, it's just pigment in the air. Try looking at the oil companies, not at me.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by walls, both movable and permanent. The feeling of space matters, call it feng shui or good vibes or whatever. Of course, the art is an important part of any exhibition, maybe the most important part, but no one is arguing that. What we're saying here, friends, is let's give some respect to the walls. Dancers need a floor, books need paper, art needs walls. But what about outdoor sculpture, you might ask? No walls needed there. And to that we say, sometimes the absence of walls is just as important, providing that sense of openness or lack of restraint. Remember that guy from The Shawshank Redemption needed that wall to prop up those posters while he dug his way to freedom.
Next January, this coming January, is the 50th anniversary of the opening of Woman House. You mentioned Woman House briefly a little while ago, and this was, I believe, the first public exhibition of feminist art maybe ever. This was at Cal Arts, and this was you and Miriam Shapiro project. But that began, I think, actually 50 years ago this year when you started the feminist art program there at Cal Arts. You know, when you look back at that 50 years ago, what's the tale of that? You know, can you see the impact of that and how it still kind of lingers over the decades?
Well, it was definitely the first female-centered installation. And it ushered in, I would say, art that allowed women to be themselves in their work. It was interesting, the eminent art writer Jory Finkel just published a review of my retrospective in the art newspaper. And it ended with the suggestion that Woman House should be recreated. I mean, a lot of art from that period has been recreated, but nobody has ever offered or suggested the idea of recreating Woman House. I realize there's copyright issues because, of course, you know, the work was done by a lot of young women who were our students, but I'm in touch with a lot of them, and I'm sure they would be thrilled to have Woman House recreated. I'm sure they would even participate in it. But, you know, it was interesting, in the 90s, there was a show at LA MoCA in which we asked some of the people associated with Woman House to recreate some of the rooms, and they asked me to recreate the menstruation bathroom. Now, here's something that really shocked me. It turned out in the 90s, the menstruation bathroom was as shocking as it had been in the 70s. I'm like, really? In 20 years, people haven't figured out that women menstruate? I don't believe this.
Can you describe for our listeners what the menstruation bathroom looks like and what that is if they haven't seen or experienced it, to kind of talk about what that was like to get, as you say, shocked back then?
Well, the thing is that I hadn't intended to make art as part of Woman House, because I've always, whenever I've taught, I made a big distinction between my own art practice and my role as a facilitator with my students. But we were working on the house, and I realized there was no reference to menstruation. And this was right around the time that I did a print called Red Flag, which I believe was the first image of menstruation in Western art, in 1971. And I had done it out of a conversation I'd had with some other women in which we were talking about our periods. And I thought about it and realized that I'd never seen an image of menstruation, which again, you know, is a universal or quasi-universal experience, right? And so in addition to doing the print, I decided to do what was called the menstruation bathroom. I took over one of the bathrooms in Woman House in the building, a non-functional, and painted it completely white, and then got a number of menstrual products and put them on a shelf. Had a white garbage can. Now, this is funny. And I remember sitting on the floor painting the menstrual pads and tampons that were going to go in the white garbage can. And all my students were like criticizing the color. No, that's too bright. That's too brown. I mean, there was like, everybody had an opinion, of course. And they were in an overflowing white garbage can. The whole environment was incredibly sterile, except for all this messy blood. And then I put white scrim across the doorway, so people could only peer in and see the sterility and pristine white bathroom kind of soiled by menstrual blood, which, of course, around the world, there are still a lot of countries where women have to go into menstrual huts and menstruation is considered dirty. And oh my God. Okay, so as I said, then I recreated it in the 90s, and I went to the market to get menstrual products and discovered there were like way more than there had been in the 70s. So I had like two, they gave me an assistant from the museum. So we both went. So I had like two baskets overflowing with menstrual products. I remember we went up to the cash register and a woman in the next aisle peered over and said, "My dear, you must have a really heavy flow."
I'd like to wrap up by saying, you know, obviously you are a child of the Midwest. Your name reflects the Midwesternness of your growing up. But, you know, living in New Mexico and you're doing this retrospective in at the DeYoung, we just mentioned your history at CalArts. You're very much associated with the West, the American West now. Do you consider yourself at this point kind of a Western artist in any sense, or that your sensibilities are impacted by that part of the country rather than the Chicago of your youth?
Well, I can still remember being 16 and going on my first trip to the West, going to LA and getting off the train. And, you know, I came from this heavy gray brick town, right? And I get off the train and here's this light, low buildings, white, open. And that was it for me. I wasn't going back. I knew I was going west. And now we travel all over the world, Donald and I, but we come back to New Mexico and we breathe a huge sigh of relief when we see the open sky.
Judith Sylvia Cohen was born in Chicago in 1939. She went by Judy Gurwitz in the 1960s, using the surname of her first husband, who had died in a car accident in 1963. She publicly announced she was changing her last name to Chicago in an ad in the October 1970 issue of Art Forum magazine. At a solo show that same year, she posted a banner in a gallery that read, "Judy Gurwitz hereby divests herself of all names imposed upon her through male social dominance and chooses her own name, Judy Chicago." Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.